Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for March 17, 2022. In the ongoing series, my work and discoveries this whole year, my radio show is going to be dedicated. Right now, we're in the middle of a five-episode series of programs dealing with what I call the Cornell years, the 2 years, academic years that I was at Cornell University, and where all the influx of data was coming in, my theoretical work I already had in place, and I was publishing papers. Now, the second peer-reviewed published paper was in a journal called The Moon and the Planets. I think it's right now it's called just The Moon, but in those days it was called The Moon and the Planets. And once again, this paper I sent directly to the editor-in-chief of a series of journals, Zdenek Kopal. It's spelled Zdenek Kopal, Kopal. And he was the editor-in-chief, and he took this paper on the heels of the Galaxy paper, which I talked about last week. And actually, there's a lot more detail in these papers. For example, the Galaxy paper, but I wanted to, I'll go into more of these details possibly at a later date. But the Moon and the Planets, the Saturn Sweeper Moons predicted paper, was monumental. Now, once again, this is a very short paper. There's the introduction and abstract, and then the conclusion is one page, and in the middle there's only three pages. But you will see this is a very dense three pages, where I set the stage once again for the plasma discharge comet model, the fusion-based capacitor system, the capture process, and the drawing in of material by small moons in the case of Saturn, but by comets in general, where they become larger and eventually become planets. So I'm setting the stage up for those papers to be published, because remember I said that I had a dilemma. When I came into this situation at Cornell, I had a 300-page book. And it had dozens of new concepts in it. Did I take that and try and publish it in one extensive article, which would have just and changing almost every theoretical topic that existed in space science, astronomy, and astrophysics? Or did I take it piecemeal, and the Galaxy article was a good way to shoe in these concepts? And the final conclusion being that the models for solar system development, where this solar system formed all from a single collapsing cloud with all the planets neatly in place and all the moons neatly in place, that system simply did not work. And so anyway, that needed to be replaced was the end goal. But anyway, with that, I will jump right into the Saturn paper here, picking it apart line by line. And once again, it's titled Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. This was received October 7th, 1980, J.M. McKenney, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, Ithaca, New York, USA. Okay, so the abstract, I'm going to go through this and read it, and once again, pick it apart line by line. But you're going to see that I hit this right in the nose, right in the beginning here. And also imagine the fear and loathing that was occurring in the astronomy department as they read this article being published by somebody at Cornell University, basically taking them to task with literally everything that they were doing. Okay, so here's the abstract. Okay, let me see. I got to pull this up again here. And let me preface this by saying something, because this is not real clear to people who are not professionals out there. The radiation belts around Saturn and Jupiter are very extensive. And these are charged particles that are caught into the magnetic fields. And Earth has similar radiation belts. On Earth, we call them the Van Allen belts. But basically, it's charged particles. The protons and positively charged particles go in one direction, and the electrons and negatively charged particles go in the other direction. And these form belts But anyway, these are throughout the Saturnian system and the Jupiter system. And it turns out that they observed that these belts, these radiation zones, were being basically swept clean by moons that were around Saturn. But what they didn't see, what they could not see, were these small moons, which I had predicted, not only because of this, but because of many other reasons, including the ring edge fading, which was very subtle. But anyway, just so you understand that that's what I'm talking about here. The radiation belts, similar to Earth's Van Allen belts, but these are around Jupiter and Saturn, and specifically Saturn in this case. Okay, so the abstract says, the recent observation of the absorption of radiation belts in the vicinity of Saturn's bright rings and historical observations of the ring system make the following related results apparent. The gaps in the rings are caused by the presence of at least six small, extremely dense, and probably electrically charged sweeper moons, which effectively sweep the ring material clean from the gaps. This is known due to the fading of the inner ring edges, whereas the outer edges are well defined. Their orbital periods will differ from expected Keplerian periods if the moons and Saturn do possess electric fields. Okay, so this is one of four bullet points in the beginning. And notice that I talk about the ring edge fading, which is something that can be observed with telescopes from Earth, but nobody understood why it was there. But if you apply the plasma discharge comet model with the tail away from the sun drawing in the material, not spitting it out as if in a dirty snowball comet model, but drawing it in, then the inner edges of the rings, the moon, which is in that gap, is drawing material in and causing the ring edge fading. Okay, and then on the outer edges of the rings, the moon is skirting there. But remember, the sun side of the, or in this case, the Saturn side of the little moon would be short. And so there will not be much fading on the outer edge of the ring. Okay, reading on, bullet point number two, absorption of radiation belts near the rings of Jupiter also implies that the ring particles themselves are not absorbing the radiation, but small moons are. This is consistent with the observed radiation belt absorption near the outer Saturnian moon. So they already observed that the outer bigger moons of Saturn, which you can see from Earth, are absorbing radiation, and of course they don't know why, because in a gravitational setting, there should be no reason for small moons to be absorbing radiation belts. So these are electrical phenomena. Third point, if electric fields of the sweeper moons cause the ring edge fading as observed, and not simply gravitational, then Saturn itself must maintain an electric field in its vicinity by way of a sizable proton wind to affect the uneven ring edge fading, and will be surrounded by an H+, a hydrogen, ionized hydrogen, atomic hydrogen cloud, at least to approximately the A ring, in other words, out to the extent of the visible rings. This is consistent with the detection of an H+ cloud surrounding Saturn, and then I give the reference to that. The other possibility is that these moons are extremely dense and have very huge internal magnetic fields. But of course, now here's what I'm doing. I'm leaving that mass alternative in there with large electric, huge internal magnetic field, because I'm dealing with people that have never heard of electric fields in space. They have now, at least in 1979, when this paper is going out, they have at least acknowledged that there are some magnetic fields out there, but they don't understand the concept that you just don't have magnetic fields floating around in plasma environments all by themselves. It just doesn't happen. Okay, so then the last point, because of their location, these moons must be captured, and if very dense, as believed, may be the core remnants of a nova. Okay, so that's just giving the some properties, potential properties of the moon. But look at what I did in this abstract. In this abstract, I laid out the plasma discharge comet model. I laid out the hydrogen cloud surrounding Saturn. I laid out the fusion-based situation on Saturn. In other words, the fusion is up in the upper atmosphere, which is the same as the Sun. And remember, I also talked about this in the galaxy paper. So what I'm doing is, although this is a paper about Saturn and its moons and these sweeper moons, what I'm doing is I'm defining all the basic properties of the plasma discharge comet model for the wider solar system, and also the fact that these are very dense moons relative to the consistency of the rings. And so the other thing is that I talk about non-Keplerian orbits. A Keplerian orbit is an orbit which is following Newton's laws. So these moons would follow non-Keplerian orbits. In other words, they would be affected by the drag of this material that they are drawing in. Okay, so now the discussion starts, and I'm going to go through this line by line because this paper is so important. And once again, this is a probably 3 to 4 concepts in this paper which are Nobel Prize winning material, because they put the key in the lock and they turn the lock where it had never been turned before in the world of physics, astrophysics, opening up the entire realm of what is really going on in outer space. So discussion point one, the possibility of the existence of small moons orbiting Saturn within the gaps of the bright rings has not received attention other than in passing comments by many investigators. Resonance theorists, now this is a very interesting situation because there were theorists at the time, this 1979 time frame, that believed that the gaps in the rings were caused by resonances. In other words, kind of like a guitar string resonance with the region in the gaps, and that's why there was nothing in the gap region. And they were still trying to believe that the rings were something left over from the beginning of the solar system, and that they had been there for 4.5 billion years, and they would be there for another 4 billion years. And it was this resonance situation that caused nothing to be in the gaps. So then I state here, resonance theorists claim that nothing can exist in the gaps, and others believe the rings to be composed of material that could not form a moon 4.5 billion years ago inside of Saturn's Roche limit. The Roche limit is a region in which loosely bound objects would be torn apart by this third-order gravitational effect called tidal effects. And this is because, for example, on Earth, the moon causes tidal effects, tides in the oceans of the Earth, because the close side of the Earth to the moon is pulled harder towards the moon than the center of the Earth, and the far side of the Earth, where the oceans are also, is not pulled as hard as at the center, so it causes this bulge at the region around the center of the Earth, around the oceans are pulled outwards, and this is a third-level gravitational force called tidal waves. Or tidal forces. And so at any rate, this was another possibility for the cause of gaps in the rings. And so these were the standing theories of the day. Then I go on to say, Pioneer 11 was unable to confirm the existence of the sweeper moons, except for one it found because of anomalous data, and no logical explanation for their existence has been previously put forth. So I'm saying, nobody has brought this argument to light before. I'm bringing it to light, and I'm pointing out all these different data points. And this is prior to the Voyager spacecraft getting to Saturn. Very important, because I'm predicting this. This is a prediction. And historical events show that the bright rings are sharply defined on the outer edges but fade gradually on the inner edges. This fading is uneven only in the B ring. These observations also have shown that the thin divisions have formed in the rings that later disappeared. So I'm also talking about the spokes, which were discovered by the Voyager spacecraft. In other words, these are thin divisions, and they're like comet tails that dash through the ring system where ring material is pulled out of the rings. And this is caused, you can see this, once the moons were discovered by Voyager, you could see that they were the cause of the spokes that were going on. And so how would a gravitational force cause effects thousands of miles away or tens of thousands of miles away? Well, they couldn't, because even if they were very dense, and this is what I'm doing in this paper, I'm setting the stage for the electrical nature of the universe. Okay, now it says, these sightings have been ignored since no explanation has been put forth. Pioneer Saturn also detected the uneven fading of the rings. Voyager's photograph of the Jovian sulfur ring also showed the same fading of the ring's inner edge. This is by Brad Smith, paper in Science in 1979. With the outer ring edge being sharply defined as in the Saturnian rings. Like Saturn's F ring, the sulfur ring has a small 40-kilometer diameter moon skirting the outer edge. Okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm saying these little moons are being predicted because of the observed effects, and it's electrical. And if it's electrical, then Saturn has to maintain an electric field by way of a proton wind, just like the Sun. So I'm saying, and now this is one of the other points, that Saturn is a small star. It's not a planet. And it's behaving like a small star. And this also means that because the core of Saturn, because the core of Jupiter are too small for core fusion to occur, that means that the fusion is occurring up in the atmosphere. Another Nobel Prize winning, Hans Bethe won a Nobel Prize for giving the chemical formula, what it's called chemical, it's really nuclear formula, for the building of large nuclei in a chain reaction, a nuclear chain reaction. And so clearly this would have been Nobel Prize quality work, understanding that the long-term, the long-held belief that fusion was in the core of the Sun was incorrect and that the fusion is up in the atmosphere. Okay, now I'm going to read on here. The detection by Earth-based radio telescope of an atomic hydrogen cloud surrounding Saturn suggests the presence of a strong proton wind emanating from Saturn. This wind would be similar to the solar wind, which seems also to have an excess current of protons. See what I'm doing here? I'm comparing it to the Sun. I'm talking about excess current of protons, the capacitor, the hydrogen cloud, which the Sun has, by the way. I'm setting the stage for the plasma discharge comet model, which are the follow-on papers. This allows a non-uniform electric field to exist between, now remember I said non-uniform, that means it's radially outward, non-uniform. Very, very important, because that's what gives the basis for the induced electric dipole redshift and the bending of light in a non-uniform electric field surrounding a fusion-based star. So anyway, it says, this allows a non-uniform electric field to exist between the negatively charged planet and neutralizing H-plus cloud. So there I'm talking about the capacitor, but notice I say non-uniform. This paper is so packed with information that it is unbelievable, looking in retrospect. Okay, reading on. The total negative charge of the planet would be equal to the combined positive charge in the proton wind and H-plus cloud. Unfortunately, it is impossible for Pioneer or Voyager to discern if the origin of certain protons are from Saturn or otherwise. However, there are indirect methods that will implicate their presence. So I'm talking here about the ability of spacecraft to detect electric fields, but the single spacecraft cannot do it. So once again, these sentences are packed with theoretical information. Reading on, this suggests that Saturn's atmosphere is operating similar to the solar atmosphere, but on a small scale. This is also supports my contention that the solar interior is not one of collapsed hydrogen, but has a large planetary-type core, since the stars and planets alike have their initial formation in the galactic center, and that refers back to the galaxy paper. So I'm tying that galaxy paper in with this, in with the understanding that fusion is in the atmosphere of stars, not in the core. Then reading on, I also believe the solar wind supports a similar H-plus cloud beyond the orbit of Jupiter. Okay, now here's something that's very interesting, because at this time, the Voyager spacecraft are venturing out, and the belief at this time was that the edge of the solar wind's effect would be near the orbit of the planet, or in this case, small star, Jupiter. And so anyway, this had, as time went on and as the Pioneer and the Voyager spacecraft went out farther and farther, they realized that the solar wind went way out, and in fact, beyond Pluto. So this is indicative of the sign of the times, 1979, where the belief was that the solar wind's effect would end at around Jupiter. Okay. And so I'll read this again. I also believe the solar wind supports a similar H-plus cloud beyond the orbit of Jupiter, and that Saturn passes through this cloud constantly as it orbits the Sun, accounting for Saturn's vast atmosphere and appearing as a small planetary nebula. So now I'm talking about Saturn accumulating atmosphere because it's acting as a comet. Do you see how densely packed this paper is? And when people read this, space scientists or NASA scientists or Carl Sagan at the time and became furious, all they could see was me shredding their belief that the solar system formed all at one time and that comets were dirty snowballs and that all of the other incorrect science they were trying to pawn off. That's all they could see, and they were absolutely infuriated. They didn't understand that every one of these sentences was packed with theoretical information that was absolutely correct. Okay, reading on. Pioneer Saturn's encounter with 1979 S2, which was a small moon, showed it to have a very high mass for its size and strong magnetic field. There are two possible explanations. One is that the small moon is very massive and possessed a very strong internal magnetic field for its size. It can also be explained, okay, now here's where I come in with the induced electric dipole redshift, which I know is correct, but I'm putting that bait out there that it could be a massive object with an internal magnetic field. But I say it can also be explained as due to the large net charge on the moon. A metal spacecraft in the non-uniform electric field, and there's that word non-uniform again, setting up the stage for the induced electric dipole redshift and the induced electric dipole force on spacecraft to cause forces on them. And this is very important too, because this is the same force that draws in the meteor stream in the plasma discharge comet model. The meteor streams are typically metal-intense or metal-rich little chunks of rock out in space. You don't find meteorites that are associated with comets that do not have metal in them. And so at any rate, that word non-uniform is critically important here, understanding that concept. Okay, so reading on again, it says there are two possible explanations. It can also be explained as due to a large net charge on the moon. A metal spacecraft in the non-uniform electric field of the moon would feel a strong induced dipole force. The induced dipole will always produce an attractive force, indicating to telemetry the presence of a large mass. The high relative velocity between the spacecraft and the charged moon would also induce the high magnetic field at the spacecraft. As specific data is not available on mass or magnetic field of this moon, a hypothetical example will illustrate the point. For a cylindrical metal spacecraft, and then what I do is I go through a calculation here showing the induced electric dipole force relative to gravitational force And then I give some actual numbers and show how that a small moon, highly charged, could give a force that's 10 to 100 times greater than the gravitational force due to a normal density object of Earth-like density. And then I go on, other evidence exists for the presence of small, highly charged objects in interplanetary space, although most investigators would rather find alternative explanations. The surface ring formations found concentric around small impact basins on Callisto, this is the moon of Jupiter, are examples. They are identical to ferromagnetic filings around a current-carrying wire. Note that the rings do not begin for a good distance around the impact basin, just as with a high current that would be associated with a discharge to the planetary surface. The small high impact, I'll just breeze over this for now. Okay, spacecraft charging in a hot plasma has been known for some time, and I refer to DeForest's paper 1972, and remains a possible source of error in Pioneer and Voyager data. Now, this is really important because even today, scientists are struggling with this idea of spacecraft measuring charged particle velocities and energies. It cannot be done. It cannot be done because in a space, in the plasma environment of outer space, where there's a non-uniform distribution of charges, then the spacecraft charges up to a potential that's equal to its local, the local potential in outer space. And it will always measure equal numbers of positive and negative particles after it reaches its charged state. And so I was in a debate with Dr. David Morrison on Coast to Coast, and he didn't understand this concept. And it's very simple. Let me give you a very simple example. Because a voltage is a potential difference. It's the potential difference between two points in space. So how do you measure a potential difference with a single spacecraft? It's impossible. And the spacecraft is out there. It has no ground. It has no wire that goes to a ground or a reference point to measure from. It's impossible. It's, for example, if you open up the hood of your car and you take a voltmeter and you say, I'm going to measure the voltage on the battery in my car. But you only go up there and you touch the red lead on the positive pole of the battery and you look for a reading. Guess what? You're not going to find any. It's going to be neutral. It's always going to be neutral, and you're going to read a zero voltage and you're going to say, oh, my battery doesn't have any charge on it. And that's what they're doing with spacecraft. These people don't know what they are doing. They're idiots. They're people that here's the problem. Here's the problem in a nutshell. Back when I was at Cornell, and ever since and before, astronomers and space scientists especially have very, very poor academic backgrounds. They jump into astronomy. They learn about stars and the main sequence and all these other theoretical concepts, but they didn't study physics, and they certainly didn't study mathematics. So they don't understand things like non-uniform electric fields. They don't understand the fact that you cannot measure a voltage in space with a single spacecraft with no reference voltage. They don't understand any of this. And I pointed this out to David Morrison on national radio, international radio, and he clearly did not understand it. Here's a NASA top scientist, Carl Sagan's favorite student, head of the Near-Earth Asteroid Program for NASA, did not understand that a single spacecraft cannot measure a potential in outer space. I mean, this is the state of things. And so clearly, when people read this paper that I wrote, they didn't understand it. All they knew that I was criticizing and basically replacing their hallowed little theories, and that's all they cared about. And that's why they had to try and blackball me and get me from out of my position and get me from publishing. They didn't understand any of this. And now you are out there, you're the public, and you can understand this. So I'm talking about other people who had observed this before, but didn't know what caused it. Okay, so then I go on and I talk about this. Let me kind of scan through this. Okay, the method of charging is not well understood, but if one assumes that size is important and noting that a small spacecraft can easily charge to 10,000 volts, extremely high voltages on a small moon would develop. And so then if you can have 10,000 volts on a small spacecraft, imagine what kind of voltage you can have on a small moon that's discharging the solar capacitor. And now people will say, well, that's impossible. You would have all this charge there and it would change the orbit. And the reality is that it's not. This is surface charge. It's charge on the surface and it's not inside the mass of the object. And therefore, it is not causing a force on the object, an electrical force. And the other thing is that as you get to bigger and bigger objects, that comparison, and this is something that I do in my three-part comet paper, which comes right after this, is that I make these calculations and I show that anything bigger than a golf ball in outer space, even though it's highly charged, it's not going to be enough to overcome the gravitational force, so that gravity is the main force you're going to see in outer space, not electrical. And so most people don't understand this. You got idiots running around the internet claiming that planets are going to go flying from Jupiter and Saturn out into the, and sit at the North Pole of Earth, and all kinds of just looney tune. Just, they have no idea what they're doing. They're idiots. And you have people that are self-proclaimed scientists on YouTube channels, and then you have NASA scientists that aren't any smarter. It's really a pathetic situation. But you can determine that the voltages we're talking about here are in the 10,000 volt range for spacecraft charging. Not a couple volts, 5 to 10 to 20,000 volts charging on a spacecraft that's discharging the solar capacitor. Okay, then reading on. The result is that the charge to mass ratio is the important quantity to consider. So here I understand that it is the charge to mass ratio that is important. And that is, an ion's charge to mass ratio is very high. That of a ring particle is smaller. The charge to mass ratio of a small moon is still smaller, and so on, whereas the total charge on each increases with increasing mass. For this reason, the most notable effects occur only for the smallest bodies. So here, once again, absolutely critical statement here that nobody understood. Once again, I'll read this again. For this reason, because of the understanding of charge to mass ratio is the important quantity, not the charge, not the voltage, but the charge to mass ratio, for this reason, the most noticeable effects occur only for the smallest bodies. That's why things like grains of sand, etc., are affected by the comet nucleus or ions or molecules, positively or negatively charged molecules. That's why they're affected by the comet nucleus electric field. But anything bigger than that is not affected. They are only affected if they have metals and with the induced electric dipole force. Okay, let me see. In a previous paper, the fading of the inner ring of Saturn explained due to the presence of six small dense sweeper moons. And so anyway, then I go through and I define the moons here. And I'm not going to go through, I'll read one of them just to give you an idea of what it looks like. The six predicted moons are as follows. I'll read the first one. Number one lies in the plane of the rings, skirting Saturn's upper atmosphere, at closest approach and skirting the inside edge of the crepe ring. This is an interesting one. I'll read the second one too. Number two's orbit lies far out of the plane of the rings and partially sweeps out the faint crepe ring. The same moon accounts for the observed non-uniform fading of the B ring edge. It fades only at two spots on opposite sides of Saturn. This moon's orbit crosses the plane of the rings where the fading is maximum. Okay, so then I go on. So I define these, and then I compare the rings of Saturn with the zodiacal disk of the sun, which is correct. That's what it is. It's a situation that occurs around fusion-based objects. Jupiter has it, Saturn has it, and the sun has it. And subtly included in this example, in this analogy with the zodiacal disk, which is a disk, by the way, you can see this a couple times a year. You can look this up on the internet to see when the dates are. And after sunset or before sunrise in the morning, before the sun comes up or after the sun goes down on very particular dates, what we do is we get exactly in line with that zodiacal disk. It's like a Saturnian type of disk around the sun, and it's primarily made up of iron. And you can see it. You can just see that line, and it's very narrow. It's a band, and it's due to, I'm not going to go into details here because I don't have time, the cause of that, but it's due to a number of the gravitational effects of the bulge of these. As they spin, they create a small bulge, and that causes a force, I'll just explain it quickly, that if the object, like in this, like an iron atom in this disk going around the sun, if it's below the ring plane, it's being pulled up. If it's above the ring plane, it's being pulled down, and that's because of the bulge in the sun, in Jupiter, and in Saturn. Saturn has an extremely significant bulge, and that causes the ring system. It's a gravitational effect, and I explained this also in the comet work. But now I want to read the conclusions here. Now, this is what I want you to pay attention to, because you can see, once again, I'm setting the stage for the larger scale comet model in the solar system. And I talk about the rings and the ring edge disappearing, the spokes which were later discovered. Okay, so now I want to get to this part that is very important. If the sweeper moons, this is reading from the paper again, if the sweeper moons are non-Keplerian, implying a proton wind for Saturn, it will suggest that an asteroid-type nucleus moving at high speed through the solar wind will charge also, causing the characteristic comet shape to form around it as plus ions are drawn in under forces that can be billions of times stronger than gravitational forces alone. Do you see what I'm doing here? I just talked about the comets becoming bigger, and I'm talking about comets now in the wider solar system. Reading on, the implications of this model of comet behavior have been worked out completely, give a reference to my other paper, and numerous observed characteristics are easily explained, such as wandering sunward spikes. Now that's very important, because I've already identified sunward spikes as a part of the electrical discharge. Okay, a shrinkage of the comet as the coma, that's the cometary cloud, shrinkage of the coma as the comet approaches the sun, curved tails, spiraling of tail material, etc. This model shows the comet to be accumulating matter and ultimately may be captured as a planet, asteroid, or moon. There I go. I'm setting the stage for the plasma discharge comet model, that they become captured, the capture process of solar system formation, as planets, asteroids, or moons. The detection of non-Keplerian moons around Saturn will support this model of the comet. Okay, and then a very short conclusion. The existence of at least six small, dense, and or charged moons are predicted as the sweepers of the Saturnian ring gaps due to historic and recent observations. The detection of non-Keplerian moons in the gaps will imply the existence of a proton wind and associated H-plus cloud in the vicinity of Saturn, providing the first evidence that sustained electric fields do exist in the cosmos. The concept, now, I want to stop here because I'm pointing out that people have seen electrical conditions, seen electrical-like phenomenon in outer space, the Birklands and the other people. but they had no understanding of this. They didn't know where it came from or what caused it. I'm putting together a complete theoretical model. It's not just a comet theory. It's a theory for how solar systems form, the entire situation with the fusion-based stars and Saturn as a small star, the hydrogen cloud, the solar capacitor, all of these aspects of the... It's not just some kind of little comet theory. It's an expansive theory that covers galactic formation in the first paper, and then all of the concepts of comets and everything they do because they are electrical, the plasma discharge comet model. Okay, then the final sentence of the conclusion, the concept of an asteroid-like nucleus moving at high speed through the solar wind, so that puts it out in the solar system, not around Saturn. I'm talking about out in the solar system. The concept of an asteroid-like nucleus moving at high speed through the solar wind, causing the nucleus to charge as a plausible explanation for comet behavior, will be supported by the existence of the predicted sweeper moons, as they exhibit the same characteristics. Wow. Okay, so that's it. That's the paper. And I took a lot of time out to explain little bits and pieces here. But that's the Saturn Sweeper Moon paper. That's my second peer-reviewed published article in astrophysics journals. And this spells it all out. 1979, and this is what I was doing with this paper. I'm talking about Saturn, I'm talking about the ring system and the sweeper moons predicted, but I'm laying the entire foundation for the plasma discharge comet model to step in, capture processes in the formation of solar systems, etc. And so this is key. These are the kind of things, this is, like I said, putting the key in the lock and turning it and compare it to something like, say, the photoelectric effect. Einstein won the Nobel Prize. Einstein did not win it for the general relativity or special relativity, which were much bigger, much more important processes in terms of physics. He got it for something extremely simple, a couple-page paper called the photoelectric effect. And so what did that do, though? It turned the key to understanding quantum physics. It turned the key. It took a very simple process of photons hitting a plate and driving off electrons over a work function at the surface of a plate, and that was it. And he won a Nobel Prize for that. And that was just one phenomena that you can show in the laboratory. So the Saturn Sweeper Moon paper, like the galaxy paper before it, had probably at least 10 scientific discoveries that were absolutely paramount to changing the direction of astrophysics. And look at the time frame, 1979. Nobody had a clue. And by being at Cornell, by being in the meetings where the data was coming in and watching these scientists, and I'm watching the same data and I'm going, this is my stuff right here. This is all my work coming to life on the big screen at the front of this conference hall. And then looking around and realizing that these NASA scientists all around me had absolutely no clue what was going on. And then they were doing little hip pocket suggestions, which later became published papers. And the whole direction of science was just stymied. And so I'm off in my corner writing my papers, sending them off to be published. And following this Saturn paper was about 10 papers. Because this opened the door for all of the other pieces of the puzzle, the plasma discharge comet model, the induced electric dipole redshift, the fusion in the atmosphere of the Sun, Jupiter and Saturn, the electrical effects, and then later to come also the things with the Marconi oscillators on the Voyager spacecraft, redshifting, and on. So the replacement of general relativity, the resolution of the missing mass, just so many physical concepts, and also the very subtle part of the induced electric dipole redshift was the understanding that there was a charge pair in the photon. This is fundamental physics at its best. And the fact that the charge pair would separate in a non-uniform electric field, because nobody knew why would a photon split into a positron and an electron as it passed by the nucleus of a heavy atom. Well, the heavy atom had a lot of protons in there, and so it had a very strong non-uniform electric field. And if there was a lighter nucleus, you might get dispersion, but you did not get charge pair production. So the photon, an X-ray photon, was sufficient energy to convert the light energy into mass, could produce the positron and the electron, and the charge was accounted for by the conversion of the light energy into mass. But where did the charge pairs come from? They were contained in the photon, and that's essential to understanding the splitting of the atom with the non-uniform electric field, the induced electric dipole force, the same one that caused the spacecraft to divert its path, people thinking it was a large mass, the same one that's used for the bending of light and the redshift, and the same force that causes pair production in the subatomic world. These are major, major keys going in the lock, unlocking and understanding. And the other thing about the redshift was that you could prove it in a laboratory. So in the laboratory, taking a light beam and shining it across the head of a Tesla coil, which was oscillating, and it was like a pin type of Tesla coil with the pin on it. So it was oscillating back and forth at, say, 100,000 volts plus and minus. And then the light beam shining through that, you could prove the bending of light with the non-uniform electric field around that pinhead. And so this was done in a laboratory proving the induced electric dipole redshift. But none of this was allowed to be published because it threatened, because it all was related. And by the way, finally around 1986, when Halley's Comet came through the solar system, and so I'm jumping ahead a little bit here out of the 1979-81 period, but around 1986, when Halley's Comet came through the solar system, there were scientists who took spectrographic equipment and telescopes down to the southern hemisphere, and they were going to take spectroscopic data of Comet Halley. And what they realized was that when they were looking down in close to the nucleus, the light was redshifted. What did they do? They threw the data away. They were afraid to publish it because of what happened to me. They would be blackballed. I got wind of this data. And also, let me give another example. But what's causing the redshift? Well, it certainly wasn't general relativity, because a comet nucleus is supposed to be this little puffy snowball with no mass at all. So it certainly wasn't general relativity. They knew the velocity of the comet nucleus was actually coming towards them, so there wouldn't have been a redshift due to the motion of the nucleus, and the tail was coming at them, so it should have been blue shifted is the point. And so what was causing this redshift? It was anomalous. They didn't know, but once again, my induced electric dipole redshift explained that, which should have been a data point in this whole discovery process. And then finally, in 1996, by the way, when I talk about the sunward spike, I do mention it in the Saturn article. And in the follow-on papers regarding the comets, I discuss the fact that that's where you will find the X-rays. In 1996, finally, by mistake, NASA discovered X-rays by mistake, turned a detector to the comet Hyakutake, and totally by mistake discovered the X-ray cloud out to the sunward side of the comet. And then they looked at Hale-Bopp, which is in the solar system at the same time. Lo and behold, Hale-Bopp showed the X-rays out to the sunward side. And then immediately they came up with this charge exchange idea. At the time, I was actively going to American Geophysical Union meetings, and met up with these yahoos who had to find some explanation that, once again, kept me out of the limelight, because I predicted in 1979 in my papers that comets should exhibit X-rays to the sunward side, and it was because of the electron beam as part of the electrical discharge, as the electron beam came in and they were bremsstrahlung or breaking X-rays. Okay, so anyway, they had this charge exchange idea, and oddly enough, recently, some scientists from Europe went back into the data of the discovery of X-rays, and they said, no, this is not charge exchange, this is bremsstrahlung X-rays, proving exactly what I said. In other words, the electron beam is coming in the nose side of the comet, the electrons slow down, and that's the source of the X-rays. They're called bremsstrahlung X-rays. In fact, it's the same process that's used in a dentist X-ray machine to, when you're, you know, they put the little thing in your mouth and then they take a picture of the your teeth, X-ray picture. They're creating X-rays through the bremsstrahlung process. Bremsstrahlung is a German word for breaking. Okay, so anyway, this paper was so important, I wanted to spend literally this whole show on it. Very important in understanding the level I was at in 1979 to 81, that time frame. And this paper was written, and remember that I submitted it to the Icarus Journal at Cornell and got a negative reply back from Joe Burns, the editor who was taking the place of Carl Sagan at the time, and saying, oh, there's no need to assume any of this. The rings are left over from the formation of the solar system, and that's the end of the story. And so anyway, and by the way, Joe Burns went on to steal my idea after turning down my paper for publication in the journal where he was chief editor. He went on to steal my idea and become the NASA expert on sweeper moons. Yeah, Joe Burns, there you go. That's what you get at an Ivy League school, that it's just corruption from top to bottom. And that's why, you know, it was an experience being there, but not a good one in all respects. But the other thing was that during the meetings at Cornell, and I had fully understood the whole issue of the bending of light around the sun also being caused by the induced electric dipole redshift, there was a meeting I went to, and there was a spacecraft that was orbiting Venus. And Venus at the time was, this was like 1979-1980 time frame. And this spacecraft is orbiting Venus. Well, Venus was on its orbit to go around behind the far side of the sun. And so what these scientists did is they said, okay, we know exactly where Venus is. We know exactly where this satellite is. And so what we're going to do is use the bending of the radio beam, the telemetry radio beam, around the sun, and we're going to do a very exact measurement of the bending of this radio beam around the sun. And so I went up, and when the data came in, they were all scratching their heads, because what it made it look like was that Venus was bouncing back and forth, moving ahead very rapidly and then bouncing back. And of course, they knew that that was not the case. So there was something causing this radio beam to fluctuate. And if it was due to general relativity, well, then it should have been very stable, because the mass of the sun is very stable. And so they couldn't figure out what this was all about, just like the data with Halley's Comet, the redshift data. They didn't know what was causing it. So guess what they did? They buried the data. Yep, they buried the data. They didn't publish it. They buried it, and no one, I had the solution there, the induced electric dipole redshift. I had the solution, but it was not allowed to be published because they had blackballed my papers. And so all of this amazing science just got snuffed because of the corruption in the scientific world. And this continues on to today. Okay. Next week, I'll be talking about the 300-page book that was really the source of all of this material. As I said, I had 10 papers going out for publication on the heels of this Saturn article, which Saturn published paper, peer-reviewed by Denik Kopal and published once again immediately. He recognized the absolute importance of this paper, sent it immediately to publication, and I had about 10 papers on the heels to him, all to be published, and he was going to publish them when he was just onslaught from the scientific community in the United States and potentially Europe, I know, from the United States. And he wrote me a letter. He said, I don't know what's going on here. He said, but basically you have caused a stir. And he said, it's like the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which at the time was called the Ice Ball Comet model. It had not graduated to Dirty Snowball status yet. It was the Ice Ball Comet model. He said that it's like a religion. He said these are axiomatic starting points, and that if you don't start with these, then they don't want you to publish. He said it makes it look like astronomy is more of a religion than a science. This is what he wrote to me, Denik Kopal, in a letter, as he was feeling pressure that he could not publish my articles anymore. And of course, what they do is they say, if you publish those articles, we will blackball your journal and nobody will publish in your journal. And that's what NASA did also with the press, is they, if any journalist would publish anything about me or anything negative about them, they would blackball that journal or magazine and nobody would ever get another word of NASA. So it was like journalistic suicide to publish something negative about NASA or something positive about my work. Anyway, next week I'll be talking about the 300-page book, which was the basis for the three-part comet paper, which was actually published after I left Cornell. But the three-part comet paper is very dense, and I'll try and move through it in a single show. We have three more shows left this month dealing with the Cornell years. And remember my webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com, where you can get a 10% discount on any of the water filter products. And by the way, I don't take donations. I don't have sponsors. That's the only way I make money to pay for my radio show, which is commercial free. And all this is free to you. So the water filters and my books, etc., the only way I have to raise money. But then also my webpage, jmccanyscience.com, the short URL, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.